Oh, good evening. We didn't blow away, did we? Not yet. It's trying. I felt like I was in the middle of a Wagner opera this morning. The thunder and lightning and the wind just roaring and the hail falling down, and it was just like, there must be somebody out there screaming at the high, very beautiful voice or something. It was just so dramatic. Gorgeous. So, I don't know how many of you have this book, or if any of you have this book, or if you have any copies of this little poem that we're going to talk about. Looks like nobody. Wendy made copies. Thank you very much.
I just have a few.
So I talked about the history of this a little bit last week. This fellow, whose name I can't pronounce, and I thought maybe Ron could help us with the pronunciation. S-E-N-G-C-A-N. Sengsan. That's what I've been saying, but I... Thank you.
It's S-E-N-G.
S-E-N-G. Yeah. Well, nobody knows very much about this one, except that he was extremely... had a great deal to do with bringing Buddhism, finding a language for Buddhism in China, and for writing this exquisite little poem that even to this day is extremely helpful. As the author of this book, Musong, said, even if we just keep the first line with us, that all by itself is worth the whole effort of his putting together this poem, that it's so useful. As you see, he uses the word way, the great way, or the Tao. The Tao is what was everyone understood in China as the sort of nature principle, and greater than a nature principle, the whole universal principle of the dynamic of how all things are. It too is very poetic. The teachers in that tradition, the Tao Te Ching, is very beautiful and very instructive. How to be like water, always going down and taking the easy way. Lots of very gentle and kindly ways of helping us to not only connect with ourself and our way to be, but with the earth that we're living on and how things actually work. How the natural world works, of which we're a part. So this comes out of that tradition, and he used it to try to convey the Buddhist idea of impermanence and especially how to achieve equanimity. This is called faith in mind, or trust in mind. But you could also say it could be called equanimity of mind. How to find our balance in a world that seems to lurch a lot. We lurch, the world lurches, and a lot of times we're just kind of like this. I was reminded the other day of the film I saw of the Frenchman who, with some friends, tied a line across between the World Trade Towers up at the top. Have you ever seen that movie? It's incredible. They did this. They sneaked up to the top of the World Trade Center and they threw a line across. And then he, at 6 o'clock in the morning, walked, not just walked on that wire, but turned around and knelt down and stood up and waved, and it was unbelievable. People spotted him and screamed. They were so but he managed it. He did the whole thing. He was one of those people who have to do something extraordinary and wasn't made any happier for it either. But that extremeness of having to keep your balance because you're between the two towers is sometimes how it feels for us. And this is a very helpful kind of quiet mind that talks about how it's not necessary, that there's another way to be. And the way is to live a life focused on meditation practice. And from meditation practice to learn to keep our balance, learn to let those things that seem to be pushing us off, to see through them. So Musong talks about the difference between suffering, which was what Buddha's basic teaching was addressing, and happiness, or sukha, which is the opposite of dukkha, suffering. And he pointed out that sukha, happiness, is the absence of suffering. It isn't some new state, some other state that we have to work hard to achieve. There's nothing to achieve. All we have to do is let go of our suffering. It's a bit like trying real hard to push a door open and then finding, oh, it goes the other way. It's much simpler than we think. So it helps to remember that. He also talks about our addiction to our preferences. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And of course we do prefer some things. We prefer to be warm and dry and well-fed, for one thing. We prefer to live rather than die, for another thing. We have many, many preferences. But what this is pointing to is our addiction to our preferences. And there are many more than just the ones that I named. And many of our obsessions with things as they are, wanting to keep everything as they are, is just the very source of our suffering. So to be told that the great way isn't difficult, it's kind of a shock. For those who hold no preferences, when love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. Love and hate are two sides of the same kind of passionate, obsessive way to be. It, as I said last week, it doesn't mean the love that we call compassion in Buddhism, or that was called in Greek and in the Bible agape, which is love, open-hearted love. But the opposite of hate is the closed, grasping kind of love, the kind of passion that's self-serving and can be very destructive. So when love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. We actually disguise the things that we see in order to make them fit better into our picture of how things should be. It's not easy to see things as they clearly are. We say we want to see what's true and real, but actually we're often addicted to our preferences of things to be different from what they are. I was thinking of it this morning when I was listening to the incessant rain that had fallen all night, just pounding on the roof. And it continued to pound on the roof, and it didn't stop. And I found that I wanted it to stop. I really wanted it to stop. It was too much. And I thought, oh, see, I'm making a preference here. It's just raining, and I'm wanting it to be something else. So there's this little tension building up in me about the rain. It's just the rain. It has nothing to do really with me, except to be grateful for it. It's filling my well with water. It's a great thing, really. And feeding the trees and all the beings. But I had an agenda, and it was just to be more comfortable and not hear such a loud noise all the time and blah, blah, blah. It was just completely, I wouldn't have noticed it except that I've been thinking about this so much, about what that addiction to preferences is really like. It's just all these little ways that our mind is going all the time, always self-serving. What can I do to optimize this situation and that situation? And of course, it is a survival thing. Of course we need to be warm and dry and fed. It isn't that we need to take all our clothes off and go out into the wilderness and be a saint in some way. It isn't about that. It's about seeing how our mind is working and toward what it's working. What its intention is. Is it a wholesome intention? Is it a useful, helpful intention for ourself and for our world? Or is it so knotted up and so focused on this sort of dream self that we walk around being, that we're not even really in touch with where we are or who we are. So Zazen is a fabulous experience for helping us to see things as they are. Once we sit down and get used to being sat down, we begin to see how we're spinning stories all the time. We can't run away from it when we sit. It's not a very pretty picture sometimes. But it's not to be sorry about or ashamed of. It's just the way we are. We are this being with the ability to think. And our thinking machine is going along all the time, no matter where we are and what we're doing. We're squirting thoughts. So then our question is what we do with it. And our conditioning has a great deal to do with it. What we were taught, what we believe about life and about ourselves. But the longer and more patient we are just sitting with what the way things are, the more clarity comes. If we drop our suffering, happiness is already there. Peace is already there. From the beginning. So Musong said an interesting thing. He was a physicist, so he talks about physics a lot. He said, like the wave particle equation of quantum energy. You know that sometimes energy is a wave and sometimes the same energy is a particle. It's like the ocean. It can be the water or the wave. Something is happening and our mind can define it one way or the other, but not at the same time both. Like the wave particle equation of quantum energy, it can manifest itself as either hate or love, depending on what conditions are present to facilitate that particular manifestation. Psychologists tell us that love and hatred are directly related. Yet Buddhist teachings tell us that the energy underneath both of them is neutral, and it is only the presence or absence of mindfulness that will determine whether the energy manifests in a wholesome or unwholesome way. Buddhist teachings tell us that the energy underneath both love and hate is neutral, and it is only the presence or absence of mindfulness that will determine whether the energy manifests in a wholesome or unwholesome way. And then he goes on to say they're both projections of our own needs, psychological and emotional needs, and that they're all projections. There's nothing out there. It's all in here. So that's the first 1, 2, 3 sets of lines. Sun Tzu has a commentary that goes line by line, and it's extensive, but I think I will go a few lines at a time. So what we've done this time is, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. The Taoists say, with clarity we embrace all things. Without clarity, we're always cutting off things and throwing them away. Questions?
I have a question.
Francois.
You said, how can, I'm not sure I'm saying it exactly the right way, how can energy directed towards hatred be wholesome in any way? I think you said that
what Sun Tzu said was that it can be love and hate are basically neutral. And that it's how we use them wholesomely or unwholesomely. Isn't that what he said?
How can hate be used wholesomely? That seems so contradictory to me.
Well, it's just an idea. It's not real. And that's something that comes up in this poem over and over again, that the things that we are thinking about and trying to figure out, and the definitions that we're using for the things that are happening, are all ideas and words. So his suggestion is that we sit down and be quiet for a while, and that we'll be able to see more clearly what is wholesome and what's not wholesome. And all those projections of love and hate, we'll have to see they're all coming from inside of us. In which case we can wholesomely deal with hatred as well as whatever lust and love we are carrying also. And it doesn't mean we throw it all out, because we can't. It's our nature. But we have to see our nature before we can function properly. And that's what this is about. Welcome home.
Thank you.
Brian?
Emotion of love and hate, how many times, I don't know if I can speak for everybody, but maybe I've really kind of hated a few people at various times for various reasons, but, you know, things change, and then maybe I get over it and even come to like them, or at least be second, but my vice versa. How many times can somebody fall in love with somebody when that changes and dissipates, just as well. So, I get this. I think somebody, in some lecture I heard once, somebody in North Korea, he talked about karma and said, well, karma isn't really this idea of, oh, I did something bad, he likes how to go and that negative 3 points and I'm getting paid back for it, but it's kind of the form. The shape that we put on something, or everything, or anything, it's a lot where we can look at this love and hate it. Well, for whatever reason, we, or somebody, a person, or maybe our cat was bad,
yeah.
And we put this form on our judgment of them, I love them, or, oh, I hate them, or I'm bad at them, I hate them. I kind of, that's my.
I thank you. All true, all true. We're fickle. And we like to think that we're just straight and true in every way, but we go in and out of it. Samia, you had something?
Well, I was thinking maybe I should wait for this question because a lot of times if we do, we kind of answer our own questions, but I'll throw it out anyway. Just thinking, you know, how we're all different, like my husband deals with situations and he just seems so calm, things don't get to him, and I don't feel like he needs to sit, he's already there because he doesn't worry that much about things. I'm thinking, how does he get there? Mm-hmm. And he says that he just puts things off till they absolutely have to be done. So I'm thinking maybe that's good. So, you know, this needs to be moved or this has to be closed because it will spill if it falls, but why do I have to keep worrying about it?
Yeah.
You know, so it could be putting things off, not a good thing, but why worry about it unless you absolutely have to do it? Is there
Yeah. I think Sung San would agree with you. I think that's what he's saying. Don't worry about what's happening next. Just be with what's happening right now. And deal with what happens next when it is right now. So, of course, you pay attention to the bottle, but then you can allow it, trust it, have faith in it, have faith in the mind of the bottle, of the world that holds it, that it will be okay. But that means having faith in things that go awry too, that it's having faith that maybe the bottle will fall over and the water will spill, and still being okay with it. It's accepting, especially, and when you think about this carefully, it's really talking about our relationship with our death. That if we truly accept our life, we're accepting our end as well. So it's a kind of waking up thing, a little tool for us to really look at our life. And the clarity that he's talking about is the clarity of seeing what this, how this is, how it is that life is living itself through us, and that we end, presumably, but it's all a much larger part of everything else. So it's a huge study, a very, very intense study about what it is to be who we are and how much we can trust the whole thing, because we know that we're, whatever we do, we're going to end. Rodney's a doctor, so that's really brave of him
to
live like that.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of courage.
He's ignorant a lot of times.
Because he just lets things go. Yeah.
Till they break or about to
yes.
break.
Yes, exactly.
He had kidney stones and he was like, go to the hospital, oh no.
Oh, doctors are always like that. They never take care of themselves.
Or the thing that I put the plates on is bending, and I want to kind of stake it. Oh no, just let it. When it breaks, we'll fix it. I'm thinking, yeah, why fix it twice? Let it totally break. See, I'm on the opposite side. I'm constantly, okay, this is going to fall. This is going to break. I'm
yes.
This.
Well, you need each other.
Yeah.
We are very interesting creatures. Mm-hmm. Truly fascinating how we are. And we're worthy of great study. Well, it's 8:00.